A postcard from China, recorded on Tuesday, the 25th of July, 2023. In early July, I made my first trip to China for 4 years. Before the pandemic, I had traveled there once a year on average since 2013, when I made our first investment in China, in Baidu, which I wrote about in my 2012 investor letter. Prior to these trips, I am always skeptical about what insights, if any, I can glean. There is one of me and 1.4 billion Chinese. I typically spend 1 week there, I do not speak Mandarin, I visit mainly tier one cities, and I speak primarily with local investors and business people with international backgrounds, not particularly representative of the average Chinese. It is not a promising starting point, and yet each time I've come back with insights I am keen to share, and despite my own skepticism, they have not aged too badly. In my H1 2019 letter, I wrote that the West was underestimating the level of innovation in the Chinese economy. And in my H1 2021 letter, I wrote that the panic around regulation and China turning its back on capitalism was unwarranted. Since then, China has produced one consumer internet company of global import in TikTok, and regulatory headwinds have turned into tailwinds as Beijing tries to reboot its flagging economy. I'm happy to report that I came back full of insights this time too. Time will tell how well they age. Livability. I was struck by how much more livable major Chinese cities have become, or at least the three I visited, Beijing, Shanghai, and Shenzhen. When I first went to Beijing, the air was unbreathable and the city was devoid of green space. I already wrote in my H1 2019 letter that the air quality had improved considerably. And this was still the case. What I noticed on this trip was how much more high-quality public space there is. I stayed in the Chaoyang district, next to the Lingma River. It used to be little more than a sewer. Today, it is a beautiful nature reserve, where you can see old men fishing and young families sauntering. It traverses the Chaoyang Park, the largest urban park within central Beijing, from which I took this picture on a run. In Shanghai, there is a cycleway along the river on the opposite side of the Bund, which is 27 kilometers in length and meanders through parks and buildings from the first to the fourth bridge. I had the pleasure of cycling the entire length of it with my good friend Stephen Shen of Ocean Link Management. The final stretch of the cycleway has only recently opened, and we had it almost to ourselves, as the word appears not to be out yet. Both places reminded me of Singapore with its beautiful public spaces on the waterfront that enable all people to have a high quality of life irrespective of how wealthy they are. The reclaiming of waterways and opening of cycle paths will not displace headlines about spy balloons and semiconductor export bans, but in terms of the long-term trajectory of life in China, I suspect they may be more relevant. A further aspect of livability is that Chinese cities are largely free of the scourges of their Western counterparts, such as graffiti, illegal dumping, drugs, and violent crime. This is due to a combination of ubiquitous surveillance and draconian punishments. Selling drugs is punishable by death, as is the case in Singapore. To be clear, I am not in favor of either a Big Brother state or the death penalty. But I'm also not in favor of rape and murder. It is a reminder that everything in life is a trade-off. City planning. Somewhat related to the topic of livability, I was impressed by the thoughtfulness of city planning in China. I'm indebted to Stephen for being my guide on this topic. Shanghai adds a net 200,000 people to its population per annum, half the population of my hometown Zurich. If you assume that the average 20-story apartment block contains 40 to 80 apartments, and 2.5 people per apartment, this implies it needs 50 to 100 new blocks per annum, excluding replacement demand. Clearly, this cannot be achieved by the odd fill-in here and there. Instead, the city builds entirely new districts. These tend to be mixed use with both residential and commercial buildings, shopping malls, and high-quality public spaces, as noted above. As a result, people can live, work, and play in their district, lessening the traffic problems that beset many large cities where people live on the outskirts and work in the center, creating traffic congestion in and out of the city in the morning and evening. I rode past Hong Kong Land's spectacular West Bund site, which is currently under construction. It will be a mixed-use development covering 1.1 million square meters and will include a cable car connecting to an enormous new park on the other side of the Huangpu River. Here is a visualization of it. See picture. Its enormous population and thoughtful city planning allow China to have far higher population densities than elsewhere, without necessarily compromising on living quality. I realize many of you will read this and think to yourselves, that's great, but I prefer to live in my detached house, thank you. I agree and won't be moving into an apartment block anytime soon. But what makes the most sense for the individual is not always the optimal outcome for society. There are enormous advantages to having denser populations. It is environmentally more sustainable and enables services such as food delivery and e-commerce at a fraction of the cost. Density is also a driver of innovation, as Edward Glaser argues in his excellent book, Triumph of the City, how our greatest invention makes us richer, smarter, greener, healthier, and happier. In this respect, China is at a competitive advantage as its cities dwarf those elsewhere. It is incredible to think that at 40 million, the metro population of Shanghai may one day exceed England's 56 million, with everyone a short taxi ride away from each other. Density, however, is not the only ingredient that goes into making a successful city. Equally important is diversity. The author draws attention to Detroit as a city that failed due to being too dependent on a single industry, namely automotive. Diversity is my next topic. Decoupled from the rest of the world. China felt more cut off from the rest of the world this time than on my prior visits. After 4 years of COVID lockdowns, I guess it was to be expected, but it was still a shock. Despite being in tier one cities, I saw few other foreign faces. I'm not going to lay claim to being a modern day Marco Polo, but my sense was that there were only marginally fewer Westerners there when the great man showed up at the Emperor's Palace. Others may disagree after my intrepid exploration into the mythical final section of the Huangpu cycleway. Most popular Western apps are inaccessible in China, and few of their domestic equivalents have English language versions. It is difficult to pay for things as cash is passé, credit cards are not widely accepted, and I struggled to set up WePay despite working my connections at Tencent. And few people speak English, even in the international hotels I was staying at, likely because their language skills atrophied after 4 years of disuse. Even the economy feels different, with too many workers, too few jobs, and declining prices. The contrast to the West could not be starker, with inflation running hot and shortages everywhere. I am not sure how China can convince visitors and knowledge workers to come back. I would hesitate to recommend going there, as even I, despite my prior experience, struggled to navigate the country and likely would have floundered if I had not had local friends to put me in taxis and order food. A big thanks, by the way, to everyone who took me under their wing there. I promise that I do not normally require the same level of supervision as a five-year-old. It strikes me as important, though, that visitors and knowledge workers do return. It is in the country's economic interest, as density alone is not a sufficient condition for driving innovation and ultimately wealth. Diversity is equally important, as Detroit demonstrates. Clearly, Shanghai has no such dependency on any one industry. I saw automotive, financial services, and internet businesses there, to name but a few. However, cultural diversity is important too. In most major Western cities, immigrants are an important driver of new company formation. The return of foreigners is also important in terms of ensuring that China and the West coexist peacefully. I remember as a school child frequently doing cultural exchanges with children from other European countries, in particular France and Germany. I grew up in the UK. The idea was not just to improve foreign language skills, but to foster relationships between the continent's young people. Europe experienced two devastating wars in the 20th century, and these exchanges, the European Union project, and many other measures, large and small, were part of the strategy to avoid experiencing a third one. If cultural exchanges played a role, and I believe they do, in securing peace in Europe, it should be of concern to everyone that there is so little cultural exchange between China and the rest of the world today, at least from west to east. battery electric vehicles, or BEVs. As with everywhere else, the hottest business topic in China is AI and ChatGPT. Run it a close second, though, is the growth in battery electric vehicles. The level of excitement reminds me of my first visit to China in 2013, when all the talk was about the mobile phone in general and Weixin in particular. The Weixin, or WeChat, of 2023, i.e. the company generating the most excitement, is undoubtedly Li Auto. I had the good fortune to visit Li's headquarters in Beijing and test drive their flagship model, the L9. See image. To stick with the mobile phone analogy, the L9 felt as different to an internal combustion engine car as an iPhone to a BlackBerry. Like all electric vehicles, it has a smoother, more relaxing ride than an internal combustion engine car. In contrast to other EVs I've been in, it has a luxurious finish with massage and ventilation in all six seats, five screens, including an enormous screen that spans the breadth of the entire dashboard in the front, and in keeping with its branding as a mobile home, a fridge. Its range, including a petrol-driven electricity generator, is 1,315 kilometers. It has the BMW X5 firmly in its sights. In my non-expert opinion, it is a superior car, and at RMB 459,800, which is equivalent to roughly $64,000, a cheaper one. Westerners that have visited China after the pandemic, okay, you got me, I was not the first, all draw attention to the massive numbers of electric vehicles on Chinese roads. I met with Yi Tao, CEO of Meidong, a large owner of BMW dealerships in China. He described the development as a tsunami. What struck me, though, was that the existing car park is still dominated by Western brands. Western car makers, apart from Tesla, are going to lose these sales unless they figure out how to build a decent EV. EV sales are currently running at 35% of new car sales in China, with domestic brands at 59% EV penetration versus just 3.7% for foreign brands. HSBC forecasts EV penetration to hit 90% of new car sales by 2030. This means that Western car makers have one model cycle left to turn things around, given the long lead times for new cars. Based on my meetings with Meidong, Li Auto, and NIO, another EV challenger, my sense is that they will not. The problem, as Tao explained to me, is not just that their electric drive units are inferior. The software integration and infotainment systems are too. In both cases, the problem is that the legacy OEMs have chosen to develop both their cars and software based on existing technologies with existing supply chains, rather than start with a blank sheet of paper based on EV assumptions. Their motivation appears to be to drive synergies with their internal combustion engine platforms, based perhaps on the belief that both platforms will exist in parallel for a long time. From the perspective of trying to wring out cost synergies from reusing components and software, this might make sense. But from the perspective of building the best possible EV, it does not. The tsunami approaching legacy Western auto OEMs and their suppliers is an underreported story in the Western press, likely because today they are posting bumper profits thanks to component shortages and rampant price inflation. It strikes me as incongruous that many European investors prefer the safety of their home markets to investing in China, when one of the main economic engines of the European economy is about to break down. Competition. I wrote on the topic of competition in my 2019 letter, writing, quote, "There is perhaps a sense in the West that the gentler form of capitalism operates in China, given the country's nominally communist roots. Nothing could be further from the truth. Competition is brutal." On the trip, one investor quipped, "The reason Western companies cannot compete with Chinese companies is because Chinese companies cannot compete with Chinese companies." His point was that all profits get competed away and then some. End quote. At the risk of repeating myself, I would emphasize again just how intense domestic competition is in China. This is well illustrated by the electric vehicle industry, which has thrown up tens of competitors. Presumably, most of them will not survive, but the ones that do will be far stronger through having gone through such a rigorous process of natural selection. I heard anecdotally that having established themselves in China, many Chinese companies find it easier to compete overseas, despite the cultural, linguistic, and regulatory barriers, as the local competition is far weaker than they are used to. TikTok and Shein are just two examples that illustrate this point. I sometimes hear Western investors express the view that the Chinese economy is doomed to fail, as central planning simply does not work, as the collapse of the Soviet Union demonstrated. I agree that central planning does not work. However, on this point, as on many others, I believe that comparisons to the Soviet Union or Russia are inappropriate. The companies I visited are in industries where competition is vigorous and regulation is light touch. For example, in express delivery, there are 6 national competitors, just 2 are solidly profitable, and the average cost to a merchant to send a parcel is just 3 RMB, which is equivalent to roughly $0.43. Brutal. The upshot of competition is rapid innovation and a better deal for customers. Any comparisons to Russia, a tiny economy that is dependent on resource extraction and controlled by an oligarchic elite, are way wide of the mark. Politics and macro. I can imagine that those of you who have read this far are wondering when I'm finally going to get to the topics of politics and economics. I deliberately left these topics to the end, and frankly would have preferred to skip them altogether. They get plenty of airtime already from people who are better qualified to speak to them than me. Furthermore, the discussion is driven by news flow, and the Western press tends to focus on news that is unusual and bad, as opposed to quotidian and good. As the saying goes, if it bleeds, it leads. This is not specific to reporting on China, but the difference is that closer to home, you have evidence of what you see around you. You read the news, fret about how the country is going to the dogs, then jump in your SUV, drive on a well-lit road to a cozy restaurant, and spend a perfectly agreeable evening in the company of good friends. As virtually no one from the West is traveling to China at the moment, there is no equivalent corrective. My fear is that by focusing on the news, people will have a great snapshot of what is going wrong at a particular moment in time, but miss the movie, i.e. what the general direction of travel is. In terms of the economy, my overwhelming sense, based on what I saw on this and other visits, is that the overall direction in terms of living standards, physical infrastructure, and economic dynamism is firmly upwards. Yes, the economy is going through a rough patch today. Youth unemployment is high, and after years of rapid economic growth, people are clearly shaken by the slowdown. Rather like the Germans, when faced with economic uncertainty, the Chinese instincts seem to be to save for a rainy day, as opposed to the Anglo-Saxons, whose instincts are to spend it while you still have it. I know whose camp I'm in. However, everything is relative. At 5%, GDP growth is weak compared to recent history, but strong compared to most other places in the world. Moreover, even the strongest economies go through cyclical ups and downs, not to mention crises. The US experienced deep recessions in 2001 and 2008, as well as a brief but violent drop in economic activity in 2020 when COVID-19 hit. In each case, it would have been a mistake to draw a wider conclusion about the overall vitality of the economic model. I suspect the same is true of China. Politics. I realize that many, if not all of you, have serious reservations about the political system in China in view of the lack of free elections as well as the restrictions on individual freedoms. I share them. I feel blessed to live in a country like Switzerland where I can do and say anything I want within the boundaries of the law. However, an important point to understand is that most Chinese enthusiastically support both their government and their system of government. A skeptic might argue that this is only because they do not know any better given the lack of critical debate. However, I do not think this gives sufficient credit to the agency of the average Chinese person. Like people everywhere, the Chinese crave first stability and then improvements in living standards. This need is especially acute in the older generation that experienced the deprivations of the Cultural Revolution. And the government has delivered. Since opening and reforming its economy in 1978, Chinese GDP growth has averaged 9% per annum, and 800 million people have lifted themselves out of poverty. People are proud of their country's achievements under the current leadership, and they have every right to be. When foreigners criticize their government, what they hear is criticism of their country. And like patriots everywhere, they do not like it. To me, this suggests a compromise that Westerners can perhaps live with. To prefer our own way of life, but respect China's. Loving your own way of life does not mean you have to despise others. As well as the Chinese economic model has worked for its people so far, it has one obvious point of vulnerability, though: the increasing dependence upon one person. Any system that has a single point of failure is ultimately fragile. History is replete with examples of leaders who become increasingly erratic and paranoid as they aged. The one tends to feed off the other as increasingly erratic decisions draw out dissenting voices, whilst the paranoia ensures that those same voices are silenced. As the leader becomes increasingly divorced from reality, the upshot is a downward spiral in the quality of decision making. This is a scenario that cannot be ruled out in China and a risk to be cognizant of. So, is China investable? Opinions will differ over the probability of a worst-case scenario. What everyone should be able to agree upon, though, is that it is non-zero. This being the case, is China investable? My answer likely will not win me many friends, but it is yes. The job of an investor is not to avoid risk, but to get paid for taking it. With sentiment towards China at what appears to be rock bottom, this is likely the case today. It certainly seems that the earnings multiples of many high-quality Chinese companies are far lower than their equivalent in the West. Most importantly, China risk is not limited to companies that are listed in China. It is ubiquitous. Many Western businesses derive a significant portion of their sales in China and/or have dependencies in their supply chain on manufacturers from China. No company illustrates this better than Apple. It derives 19% of its revenue from China, nearly all its iPhones are assembled there, and is reliant upon the component supply chain in China. Are people really worried about China with Apple close to an all-time high and trading on 31 times earnings? Or are they just turned off by the Chinese stock market, as it's been out of favor for such a long time? I do not believe people generally understand just how dependent China and the West are on each other economically. Any type of confrontation between the two blocs would have disastrous economic consequences. To pick just one example, virtually all high-end electronics are dependent on chips made in Taiwan. This means you can basically chalk off the production of anything that requires a high-end chip in the event of a conflict. My sense is that people's mental model of a confrontation with China is based on the current confrontation with Russia over Ukraine. As I've already written, I do not believe the analogy to Russia is at all helpful. Europe imports, or rather imported, primarily commodities from Russia, which can be imported from elsewhere at moderately higher logistics costs. The interdependency with China is of an entirely different order of magnitude, as the Apple and microchip examples illustrate. There are many more examples I could have given. The West needs to engage with China, and it needs to get on with China. I hope this note plays a small role in encouraging more people to do so. Thanks for listening, and happy investing.